Welcome to Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That as part of the Zesty Garden. Jerry Goodspeed is USU's horticulture extension agent, and he's in studio with me. And we're going to talk about common grape hyacinth, or Muscari botrytis.
Let's just call it grape hyacinth.
Okay, thank you very much. Now, these are the little plants that come up in the early spring, and to me, they do smell like grapes.
You get close to them, you get a lot of them together.
Yep. They've got this nice smell to them. However, I've never seen them on anyone's don't plant that list. Why is this one here?
Well, because there are a couple of what they call grape hyacinth, and the true grape hyacinth is probably pretty good to plant and does a really good color, but the Muscari is a little bit smaller, and it is normally sold. The way that we see it sold is normally in catalogs as a very cheap filler. And when you buy the cheap filler, look at the scientific name and make sure that it is not a Muscari, because what they will do is they will reseed, and they will invade lawns, and they will invade flower beds. They'll invade a slow Chevy, you know, whatever it is they can get next to, they will start to grow in. And it can become a very noxious weed. It can. So the Muscari is the ones that we're trying to avoid. Wait, wait, don't plant that.
So
the larger grape, they're larger, what they call purple hyacinth, or the larger hyacinths are fine.
And how much bigger are those than the Muscari?
Usually the Muscari are only about anywhere from 4 to 6 inches tall. They can be a little bit taller, 8 inches, but that's typically what they are. But again, where you will normally find them is a lot of people will buy them from a catalog because they're very inexpensive.
They just get the bulbs?
Uh-huh. You just get the small bulbs, and they're very inexpensive. And you can go, you know, most of the nurseries and garden centers will not sell them, but the place we see them, as I say, is usually the inexpensive catalogs. I don't know what to call them, cheapies or, you know, the people trying to make a buck. I always tell people if you can go to your garden catalog and it offers not only plants, but it offers, I don't know, a swing set, and it offers a shovel, or, you know, and it that you can make money back or a rebate or a lottery or anything like that, you probably shouldn't be buying plants from it. And if that plant arrives in an envelope, then you probably really shouldn't be buying plants
so
from
it. So we can also turn this into the wait, wait, don't read that, don't, or order that segment. I'm just going to say Michigan Bulb Company. Just avoid it like the plague.
That's one of them.
Hard lesson when you order from a catalog and you get a bunch of stuff, and it's like microscopic. You can't even see it.
As I say, if you receive your tree or your plant in an envelope, just in the mailbox, that's probably not a good sign.
All right, so common grape hyacinth. The regular grape hyacinth is okay. Just look for, don't
Muscari.
Plant the Muscari.
Yep.
And so it spreads by bulb, but more by seed.
Seed, yeah, it'll reseed all over the place, yep. And the bulbs will multiply as well.
And so what if the catalog doesn't tell you if it's Muscari? What do you look for? Things like...
I would just avoid it then.
Very adaptable.
Yeah.
Or
grows anywhere.
Naturalizes. Yeah, grows anywhere.
Yeah, that naturalizes is always a scary word. Yeah.
Okay, so avoid common grape hyacinth, especially the Muscari. How do you pronounce this?
That's exactly how you pronounce it. You're good. Muscari. It's one of those, you know, we ought to have a segment that has how do I pronounce Latin names, because it just depends on where you grew up or where you're at or anything like that. So my opinion is however you pronounce it is a proper way.
Okay. Hyacinth, common grape hyacinth. Not to be confused with the regular hyacinths,
yeah,
which
are you'll get the
like
large,
growing about 8 inches tall.
Yeah, those are beautiful plants.
Those work really well. And that's Jerry Goodspeed's recommendation on today's Wait, Wait, Don't Plant That. Jerry, thanks for coming in. Thank you for joining us on the Zesty Garden. In studio with me right now is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. You can also send us your email question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or if you'd like to make a comment on Facebook, go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page. Dan, thanks for coming in.
It's good to be here again.
Plenty to talk about. First thing I want to start off talking about, though, would be heat stress issues. And we covered that a little bit last time, but not necessarily about ripening and what the plants are looking like and how that can be taken care of if it can.
Yeah, well, it's, you know, been hot. If anything, we can say that that's for sure. It's been really hot. And so, you know, our vegetables tend to be impacted by those types of conditions. And oftentimes, I notice it in some of my squash when I come home at night. You know, I've got them on a drip system. I don't have them being irrigated every day. I probably should switch it over to every day. But with my zucchini and that kind of stuff, not having squash every day is maybe sometimes a blessing. So, you know, I'm not too concerned about that. We're getting plenty of squash, you know, and we eat, love it and that type of thing. But, you know, I see that plant wilting and you'll see a little bit of flagging in the leaf and the plants are under a slight amount of stress. And that then also affects what the shape of the fruit is going to look like. And it can impact the flavor. And so heat does a lot of things to plants. I mean, certainly it how it looks, the shape of the fruit may actually be impacted, or we may see other symptoms on those fruits.
So when you're looking at something like a zucchini that grows pretty fast, what would you see on that?
Well, what I'm seeing on mine is the variety that I grow regularly has kind of a stubby type of fruit that tends to be really uniform along the whole length of the fruit. And what I'm noticing in mine is because of those little stress events is that it grows fairly well up by the stem end, but at the flower end of the fruit, it tends to be a little bit on the pointy side. And that's usually a symptom that says that the plant has been under some stress. We'll see it in bean, oftentimes in snap beans or in your pole beans, where the number of seeds that normally would set within the pod, some of them don't set, and so you'll get kind of a blank, and you'll get this hourglass-shaped pod where if some of the seeds in the center of the pod don't fill, then you get kind of fattening up near the stem end, you'll get flattening down at the bottom end, and in the middle you'll have this kind of thinner spot that's indicative of the heat stress that the plant is being responding to. The other thing you'll maybe see in snap beans is because that some of those seeds don't set, the bean actually isn't straight anymore. It's actually quite curved. Now, curvature isn't always necessarily associated with heat because if the pod is fairly close to the ground and it hits the ground and it has to push its way around from there, you're going to get some curvature. But mostly if there's up higher in the plant, and certainly on our pole beans, you'll start seeing more curvature in the pod, and that's an indication that the plant has been under a little bit of stress. And it's the heat that drives the water demand, and oftentimes our soils may have sufficient moisture in them, but the transpiration of the plant is so great because we got so many leaves and so many things going on that plant that the plant just actually can't get enough water throughout the whole plant, and you'll see these symptoms showing up. And if it's sufficiently severe, where the plants are under some severe stress in plants like bean, plants like tomato, plants like pepper, which are, we're interested in the fruits, the flowers actually may abort, and you may find periods where the plant just doesn't have as many fruits on it. And oftentimes in late July and early August, you'll see these periods of non-setting, and we call it blossom drop or heat stress related blossom drop that is associated with a moisture issue and the heat load that the plant is trying to cope with.
So when you're looking at a plant like a zucchini or a squash plant that's a mature plant and has a lot of shade to the plant itself for the ones on the top, do they get through this a little bit better if you've got enough moisture in the soil versus a bean plant, which is if you've got pole beans and they're, that water's got to travel 8 feet up in the air depending on how large your trellis is?
Yeah, it can. I mean, plants are pretty good at coping with those kinds of things. And shading within the canopy helps a little bit for the shape. But the leaf itself is so large relative to the size of the fruit that predominantly water tends to move toward those leaves preferentially because that's where the drive and drive demand is due to transpiration. So water loss is out of the leaf is occurring at a much more rapid rate out of the leaf, and not so rapidly out of the fruit. And so you get preferential movement toward where the demand is greatest, and that's the leaf. And that's why you get these little bits of shortages in the plant that cause some of these symptoms that we see. A little bit of curvature, maybe a seed set issue, maybe a little bit of pointiness on the end of your zucchini or your cucumber, a little bit smaller fruit size on things like watermelons. I know the Green River watermelon growers were all complaining a little bit about the fact that they just didn't think they were getting the sizing this year that they have historically gotten. And you know, we had an awful lot of hot days down there and a relatively low relative humidity, so that creates a lot of drive for the leaf to lose water. But
I'm just going
to
say, if we're in the east where it's more humid,
that's right,
then that's
not necessarily such a problem. So, you know, the growers were kind of trying to understand that a little bit better, and I was down there a week or so ago, and the melon quality was fantastic. The flavor was off the charts, you know, in terms of the sugar content that was in them. The color was great, but they just felt that they had more smaller size melons, and they have a market for melons that are in this 20 to 25 pound range that they ship up to the Wasatch Front. And they said they weren't getting as many of those, and they were trying to figure out ways to do it. And I said, well, you know, that's an issue that comes when the fruit is sizing, and all the sizing occurs, you know, it takes about 30 to 35 days for a watermelon to mature and ripen. All of the sizing occurs in days 1 to 15. So, you know, if you don't take care of it early, and that's why it becomes so critical when we're looking at fruiting type plants to manage water, manage nutrition, manage plant health, manage stresses during the first part of the fruit set process rather than at the end of the fruit set process. Because fruit sizing occurs fruit first, and then during the last half, that's when all the maturation stuff goes on. That's when the color occurs. That's when all of the flavors start to build up in the fruit. That's when the sugars accumulate within the fruit. And so you need to be thinking about these fruits in two steps. The first step is to size them. The second step is to match the maturation process and the ripening process. And if you screw up the first part, it doesn't necessarily impact the second part in terms of flavors and things like that, but it does impact your size. And if you have the expectation of size, that's, you know, something that you're going to have to correct much, much earlier. And once you see that it isn't very big, there's no way to grow it anymore.
So Green River doesn't strike me as being a very cool place at all. So I would imagine they're kind of always on the hairy edge because they're in desert country. It's going to be warm anyway, so they do kind of just okay, and then a year like this hits.
Yeah, I think, you know, most of the time they're pretty good about it, and it depends, but more of the growers over there, and some of them are really beginning to look at, you know, changing over from their traditional furrow irrigated system to more water conservating systems like drip irrigation. And so they're trying to come to grips with how to irrigate, and so that's a whole new skill set that they have to learn, because it is very different when you switch over from, you know, furrow systems where you put lots of water out in the field and it soaks really deep and you run a lot of water through and it's kind of wasteful, but it also does a very effective job of filling up the profile and making sure that the plants aren't under any stress. And so the one grower that I was dealing with, his issue was he's got quite a bit of drip in this year, and that's where he was complaining that his size wasn't there. And so we were going through what they were doing, and we found, yeah, they were shorting the water a little bit at the early part of the season, like they do in their furrow systems. But because the wetting pattern is quite different, the shortage actually impacted both vine size, and then it also impacted early fruit sizing. Whereas in their furrow system, they could get by with it because when they did apply an irrigation, it was a lot more of water that was going back into the field, and the plant was kind of utilizing that as a way of getting both big enough plant as well as big enough fruit.
When you have that kind of heat, I guess the homeowner, if they wanted to, they could always put on a floating row cover to try to cut that down a little bit. if the farmer is doesn't, I mean, I can't see imagine a whole field full of floating row covers. So what would they
do? Well, they are doing that. There are places that are, you know, spending tremendous amounts of money on these protective means. But one also needs to remember that in the middle of the summer, a floating row cover may not necessarily do what you think it's going to do. And the reason for that is that you essentially trap heat around the plant. And so with a wind event and with some air movement, we can actually move heat away from the plants. And if you put a floating row cover over top of a plant at this time of the year, what we actually find is the temperature underneath the cover is slightly warmer than it is outside, where it can be dissipated because the wind tends to flow over the plants and actually move the heat away from the plants.
Well, and as you already mentioned, trying to get them cooler is not going to do much good now. It was back in June when the temperature was
Absolutely. I mean, you know, that's the neat thing that you need to learn about plants is that, you know, it starts from the day you sit down in your chair and start thinking about it. You need to be thinking about all of these things. And then once that seed is in the ground, it's not just walk away and expect an abundant harvest. Lots of other things are happening out there. And so particularly with our fruiting crops like our melons or our tomatoes and peppers, maybe beans and peas, all of those, you know, that early flowering period is a real critical time for all of the things that are going to come later. And you can really reduce your productivity significantly by kind of messing up just that flowering. And so, you know, people, we can't do much about it now. But if I look at my tomato plant that's in my yards and I look at commercial tomato fields, they're still flowering, many of those plants, particularly the indeterminate types. Most of the determinate ones, the ones that kind of grow for a certain period of time, set some fruit, and then stop doing everything, and all they do is mature those fruits, those are done. You can't do anything about them. But if you have an indeterminate type or a partially determinate type, those things are continuing to put out new flowers, and you need to be thinking about those new flowers and how they're going to grow and mature and develop. And, you know, we don't really want to stress them now because we're only in early August, and we can have tomatoes out of our garden if we're a little bit careful all the way until the end of September. So there's a lot of time for those tomatoes to do what they're going to do, and we can still mess it up on some of the later set fruits.
So much of gardening is thinking ahead.
It's thinking ahead. You know, it'd be nice. It would be really nice if, you know, you could just wander, put it out there, kind of not think about it, and then just go back at some point and harvest a bounty of produce. And our environment doesn't really allow us to do that. We need to be managing all the things that are going on. And I can't manage the weather too much, but I can manage other aspects of the vegetable garden and certainly how I irrigate it, you know, how much competition is out there, which has to do both with, you know, the density of the plants that I'm interested in, as well as all those weeds that always grow. And, you know, you go around now and some people have really clean gardens and all they have is their vegetables out there. And then there are others that have lots of weeds growing in there and there's a lot of competition. And so, you know, things are going to be different in that garden as well.
You're listening to The Zesty Garden. Dan Drost is USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, and he'll be with us for the entire hour. If you'd like to join our conversation, the toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can also send us an email. It is zestygarden@gmail.com, or you can also comment on our Utah Public Radio Facebook page. So looking at some issues that may be related to heat or may not. My dad had a question. He says, why are our cucumbers so bitter? And I said, well, one of the reasons could be the variety that you chose. Some just tend to be more prone to doing that. But what causes bitterness in a cucumber?
Well, the compound is cucurbitacein is the long technical term for it. And cucurbit comes kind of from that. And so they named that compound after the broader family of plants, and it's just a bitter terpene that's concentrated pretty much in the skin, and it tends to be more concentrated both on the stem end and on the flower end. There's concentration of those compounds in the skin at both where it attaches to the plant and where the flower used to be. And it's brought on by heat. Heat builds up these compounds within the plant. And so all of the cucurbits produce these compounds. In most cases, we don't notice them that much. The zucchinis and some of those kinds of squashes don't have a lot of this compound in them, so they're fairly low on it, so we don't normally notice that. But cucumber is notoriously prone to building up this compound under heat stress conditions or water stress conditions or nutrient stress conditions or pest stress conditions.
Whatever reason happens to fit.
Whatever one fits. So if you've had, let's say, a mite problem or an aphid problem in your cucumber patch, which are fairly common insects that we see in there, that puts stress on the plant. You'll see more of these compounds. If you've kind of been failing to water a little bit as efficiently, you're going to build up these compounds. We've had really hot conditions. If you've been underwatering, like I've been underwatering my squash, you may build up these conditions. So we had some cucumbers the other day, and I noticed it in them. That last night we put together a cucumber salad, and it had some olives and oil and a little bit of vinegar in there and some red onion and some feta cheese. And I didn't peel the cucumber, and I cut off the flower end and the stem end, but I left a little bit too much because I only had so much cucumber, and I wanted the salad to stretch a little bit. And I noticed it when I was biting in it, and there were odd times I would catch some of the flavor, and then there were other times where I didn't. And I know that I probably should have peeled a little bit more of that skin off, particularly up on the blossom end or on the stem end. And it wasn't offensive, but it was there. Now, the other thing is that some people are more sensitive to it as others. Your tongue, actually, you may just cue in on those off flavors a little bit more than somebody else. And so that can be, your father's problem this year. A little bit of stress, and he's just more sensitive to it than you are. And so how do you solve the problem? Well, I would always say just a little bit more water to make sure that the plant isn't under stress. You're probably going to continue to see some as long as we have these high temperatures. You know, they're talking mid-90s again today here in the valley and, through the Wasatch Front. And it's going to be hot. It's going to be hot for another week. I don't know what the long-term forecast is. But you may see it. And then as it starts to cool off, it'll go away. The plant will break these compounds down. And it doesn't really have anything to do with the fruit age either. Some people think, it's an old fruit that's more bitter. Well, sure, it's going to build up some more of those compounds. But remember, it's only in the skin. And as the fruit sizes, there's more pulp in the inside than there is skin on the outside. So actually, it may be actually a little bit less.
So it's only in the skin?
It's pretty much only in the skin and, several millimeters down into the flesh. So, peeling off that skin is one way to help to minimize that. And if you start seeing those green tones in the flesh inside the cucumber, those are areas where it's also going to be much, much more concentrated.
So if I'm just thinking of this theory in my mind here, and you please correct me if I'm wrong or not. So this plant is stressed. So its main quote unquote concern is to make sure that you get hydration, you get moisture out to the leaves, and so it's not going to be getting rid of those compounds. Is that why that happens? Those compounds are there, but because it's so busy trying to get water out to the plant.
Yeah, I mean that's probably part of it.
Okay.
They're fairly much evident. The expression of the genes that cause the formation of these compounds get turned on. The gene does and therefore expressed, and therefore the plant makes more of these compounds, particularly when it's under stress. And it's particularly bad, what I've noted over the years, is if you have an insect infestation. It's almost like a mechanism to try and ward off the insects. I'm building up these toxins. I don't want these insects to feed on me, if you can think of it that way. But any of the stresses will do it because they're just stress response compounds. They're there. they're just not always expressed in such large quantities.
So when you look for a variety, will there be some that will say has less likely to be bitter?
And you know, you'll look for those kind of things. Those would be the ones to try. And many of the older varieties have more of these compounds. And certainly the plant breeders know that they're there, and they've been working very hard on trying to, you know, down express the genes that cause these compounds, simply because people don't like them. And certainly the commercial farmers that are trying to sell cucumbers to the masses don't really like them either, because, you know, people think they don't taste good, they don't buy cucumbers. And if they don't buy cucumbers, that's not good for the farmers. And certainly from a home gardener's perspective, it seems like they are more common in the salad type cucumbers rather than in the pickling type cucumbers. And there is some indication that it has to do with whether it's a spine type or a spineless type. And so if you notice a cucumber, sometimes they have more spines on them, and all the spiny ones tend to be like the pickling cucumbers, yeah. And they have less of it, and the spineless ones tend to sometimes have more of it. So there's all of these interconnections that people are working on, trying to say, well, how do I get rid of this? Because, customers don't like it.
Well, and again, it goes back to possibly an adaptation. If you've got more spines on,
less things are going to try and chew on you. Yeah, absolutely.
So, okay.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting little nuances that go with these things, and ultimately we just see it in our salads and say, ew, that one kind of was a little strong, or ooh, that's a little bitter. And
so peel it. Salvage that cucumber by peeling it.
Yeah, and sometimes you got to watch it, because, like I said, you know, it's associated with the chlorophylls and the green component of the fruit. And so it's up more in the skin, but sometimes that color tends to migrate deeply into the flesh. Well, you might have to peel it a little bit more deeply as well in order to get rid of it.
Well, we're going to transition for just a moment to take a hike, a little transitional music for that, and then we'll also have our gardening calendar, but then Dan Dross will be back for the rest of the hour. If you have a question or comment, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. You can email us your question. It's zestygarden@gmail.com, or go to the Utah Public Radio Facebook page and send your comments or question that way. So stay tuned.
Summer means lots of fresh fruits and vegetables, and that means lots of kitchen scraps to manage. Don't send them down the garbage disposal or throw them away. Instead, recycle them in your gardens. Hi, I'm Melinda Myers, horticulturist and gardening expert. Worm and pile composting are great ways to manage these scraps, but if these methods aren't for you, try trench composting. Cut the kitchen scraps, no meat, fat, or cheese, please, into smaller pieces whenever possible to speed decomposition. Then bury them in a hole in a vacant space in the garden. It's really that easy. My friend Ray would always trench compost in the pathways of his garden. He would bury plant waste in the paths throughout the summer. The following season, he would use the amended pathways as the planting area and the last year's planting beds as his path. That way, he was continually recycling kitchen scraps, improving the soil, and rotating his crops. Check out our website for this and other gardening tips.
Programming on Utah Public Radio is made possible in part by our members and Intermountain Medical Group doctors Gary Harris and Bart Avery, welcoming Dr. David Amott to the new North Cache Valley Medical Clinic on Highway 91 in Hyde Park. Appointments being accepted at 563-4800. Support also comes from the Utah Shakespeare Festival, presenting the regional premiere of Peter and the Starcatcher, with 7 other productions through October 2013 in Cedar City. www.bard.org.
I'm here with David Wallace. He's on the board with the Utah Native Plant Society and with Cache Hikers, and we're going to talk about a hike. David, the first one that I'm looking at is the hairy clematis. This is one that you had sent to me. They've got fuzzy seed heads that appear in July. The flower itself is gone at this point?
Well, I was up there in mid-July, and it's still hanging on a little bit if you look closely. that's just the actual flower. The flower itself is not really spectacular. It's dull purple and it's really fuzzy and thick leaves, so much so that it's sometimes called leather flower. And the shape is like a sugar bowl, so that's another name for it as well.
When I think of clematis, I'm thinking of what we usually see in the homeowner's yard. It climbs up a trellis and it has these big showy flowers. How is this one compared to that? You're not looking for anything like that, are you?
It's completely different. It's a non-viney member of the genus. Its flowers are, instead of big and wide and open like the clematis that you'll see in cultivation, this is a much smaller, tighter, urn-shaped flower. It's nodding. It hangs straight down. It kind of the plant itself is maybe a foot tall, and the flowers poke up above it, pointing downward, and then as they mature, they'll turn straight up and then turn into this fuzzy ball of seed head. And that's what's happening right now. The flowers are just changing from being in these dull purple hanging things to the upright fuzzy ones. What's really interesting is I think that the seed heads are just as interesting to look at as the whole flower. As I mentioned, the flower is kind of nondescript. It's interesting. They're all interesting. But later, when it has this real fuzzy seed head poking up there, it reminds you of a Dr. Seuss book. In fact, that's what my wife calls it. It's the Dr. Seuss plant.
Because they look like truffula trees?
Yeah. Well, I don't know the name, but okay. They're really kind of cool. And they'll last all clear until fall. I've seen them in October still out there, the seed heads. So you could go look at the seed head part anytime.
How tall are they?
Okay, the whole plant is maybe about a foot tall with the seed heads and the flowers extending above that another a few inches more. Everything will be less than knee high.
And what type of area will you see them growing in?
This grows in the open meadow areas. You'll find it along with sagebrush and some of the other meadow plants. Buckwheat, for example, grows around it in that same kind of location. It's a plant that I first knew from the High Uinta Mountains along the Highway 150, the road that goes up to Mirror Lake. I'd stop down near the Provo River, and I'd see it in the sagebrush meadows there. But I was really pleased to see that it grows up here, and we get a chance to see it.
In looking at its distribution, it looks like it's found throughout the inner Mountain West anyway, quite a bit in Colorado. So its distribution, at least in Utah, is there quite a few locations where it has been identified. How widespread then would you see it? Would it just be a specimen here and there, or do you usually see them in a community?
When you see one, you usually see more. That's the case in the Uintas in my experience there, and it's how it is up here at the along the White Pine Trail, where we'll talk about where you can find them. There's a big meadow there. Well, here, let's talk about the trail.
I was going to say, talk about the trail.
This is the White Pine Trail. It starts at Tonu Grove. We've talked about Tonu Grove Lake and that location in our previous sessions. To get there, you drive 20 miles up Logan Canyon from Logan, turn from the highway towards Tonu Grove for 7 miles, park there, you have to pay $6 fee, and head off on the trail. The trail starts at the west end of the parking lot, and there's three branches to the initial trail. One goes to campground, picnic areas. Another goes to the nature trail, which we've talked about before. And this third trail heads up towards White Pine and Naomi Peak. Now, after about a quarter mile, the trail splits. So you take the right-hand fork going towards White Pine Lake, and within another quarter mile, you'll encounter a large meadow, and that's where you find the clematis.
At the same time, you're going to see the columbine that we talked about a couple of weeks ago is also on this trail.
Well,
if it's not gone already.
Well, we specifically mentioned the nature trail to find the columbine, but mm-hmm. it grows up here as well. It won't be out in the open meadows, but if you were to leave the trail and walk and look in some of the shady areas around the edges, there's a good chance you'll find it there as well. The Tonu Grove area is one of these great places where you can find all sorts of stuff if you just look around.
I grew up on the west side of Cache Valley and hiked in what I know as the Mendon Mountains all the time. And so I didn't get over to this other side very often. But one of the trails that I've done more than a few times is the White Pine Trail. I've been camping at White Pine Lake with my dad and brother when I was younger. And usually when I take visitors, that's where I'll go because it's not a hard trail.
It's a great trail. If you only wanted to hike a short distance, another, say, half mile to a mile, you'll see the clematis. But if you keep going, it's about 3.5 miles, I think it's 3.8 miles technically, all the way to the lake. The White Pine Lake is a really nice natural lake in our northern Utah mountains. As you mentioned, it's a popular destination. There's established camp areas for backcountry camping. There's even a toilet that I think was brought in by some Boy Scout projects. It's currently out of service, but the sign on it says the Forest Service will try to get it fixed.
And that's at the lake?
That's near the lake.
Oh, okay.
Uh-huh. It's, a popular area. You'll see if you go in on Friday or Saturday, you're likely to see people camping there. It's a popular Boy Scout destination as well.
Why don't you talk about the topographical change in the trail? It's fairly great going up, but you do drop down into White Pine.
The Tony Grove Lake and White Pine Lake are about the same elevation, but you'll slowly climb. There's some ridges between them, as you mentioned. So you head to the north, take the right-hand fork, as I mentioned, which goes to White Pine Lake, and it'll slowly, gradually climb up past the meadow. There'll be actually a little sign you might notice that says Naomi Peak. There's a little loop trail that you can take, swing back to Naomi Peak. And I like to take that on my way to White Pine so I don't have to walk back my own tracks all the way. The trail gradually climbs through open meadows, a few scattered trees here and there, and you'll eventually come out on a ridge overlooking White Pine Creek. And then it'll be steep down, so it's about maybe 400 feet of climbing and then gently for over about 3 miles, and then a fairly steep 800-foot drop into White Pine Lake area where you'll have a nice destination.
So the only thing to be aware of is that you have to take that 800 feet up coming back out, but it happens right at the beginning of your return hike back.
Yeah, the whole thing is a fairly gentle trail. Any hike that has less than 1,000 feet, as far as I'm concerned, is a pretty easy hike.
This is a trail you could take family on. Kids can go on this trail. It's a non-motorized trail.
Right. Bicyclists will be on it occasionally. You'll see equestrians. It's just a good trail for a lot of purposes. Yeah, it's a well-maintained trail. It suffers a little bit from overuse. I would advise people, please do not cut the switchbacks. That leads to erosion, and it's a lot of extra work for the trail maintenance employees. There's a few signs that have been damaged in the past. Right now, most of them are okay, so please don't damage signs either. And this is not the right season, but I might add to the snowmobilers, please do not ride your snowmobile over the bridge. Handrails have all been broken down because of snowmobilers that have done that in the winter, and the Forest Service has not been able to repair it yet.
And the snow gets fairly deep up there, and so when you think you're riding on the bridge, you're actually riding over the top of the handrails and so forth. I'm assuming that's how
it's
broken down.
It's a footbridge with handrails along the sides, and they were all smashed up here a couple of years ago. It's a very popular area in the winter with the snowmobilers.
Anything else that you would like to say about this flower or the trail itself?
Well, like I said, I can tell you the flower is very interesting, and I love those little pom poms of the Dr. Seuss plant look. As far as the lake, it's a very pleasant lake. There's a nice cliff on the far side of it, on the west side. When you enter the valley there, there's two mountain peaks that on each side. One's called Gog, and the other is called Magog. And it's interesting that there's some biblical references there, and also some mythology. Apparently, the two giants that protected town of London were called Gog and Magog by mythology. Anyway, kind of interesting. I don't know who named it, but they had a couple of different sources to call on.
Well, David, thanks for coming in with us.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Take a Hike with David Wallace. Stay tuned for the rest of Zesty Garden coming up in just a bit. In our gardening calendar, the Wasatch Community Gardens is hosting a workshop on seed saving. It's on Saturday, August 17th from 1 to 3 p.m. at their Fruit Heights location. Learn how to select plants and vegetables to save seed from and how saving your own seed is a vital part of becoming more self-sufficient. Registration is required at wasatchgardens.org. The USU Extension Office in Cedar City is hosting a garden-to-table workshop Thursday, September 12th from 4 to 6 p.m. You'll learn tips from making the most of your garden through simple preservation methods. The workshop covers a little bit of everything from homemade pizza to baby food. The Extension office is at 585 North Main Street in Cedar City. Registration is required by calling 435-586-8132. And then as far as gardeners markets, the Ashley Valley Farmers Market in Vernal is held each Saturday from 8 a.m. to noon at 150 East Main Street. Ogden's historic 25th Street Farmers and Art Market is each Saturday from 8 to 1 on 25th Street and Grant Avenue. Well, in studio with me for the last 13 minutes of the program is Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist. And if you have a question or comment, you better get it in quick. Otherwise, the time will go by real quick and you will miss your opportunity. So first, go to our Facebook page, Utah Public Radio, and if you have a question or comment, post it there. If you'd like to email us your question, it's zestygarden@gmail.com. Or call our toll-free number, 1-800-826-1495. That's 800-826-1495. So, Dan, we were talking during the break about onions, and I've got my father questions.
Yeah.
He said, my onions have quit sizing up, and they're flopping over.
They are getting themselves ready to be harvested. That's all that's happening. Now, you may say to yourself, well, it's early August. Why aren't they just continuing to grow? Well, maturation in onion is brought on by long days. So are we in the long day time of the year? Yes, because it gets light early and it gets dark late. So we are in the long day time of the year. So that's one indicator and trigger for getting them to mature. And the second one is high temperatures. And I think we've already talked about high temperatures. Yeah. So your father-in-law, if you told me correctly, bought some transplants. Transplants tend to mature faster than seeded crops do.
And he planted them in April.
And he planted them in April when they were supposed to be planted. They grew nicely for a long time, but now they've gotten all the signals that tell them to stop growing, and the tops falling over is a sign that they are getting ready to mature off. So I wouldn't necessarily lift those onions. I would just let them kind of lay there. If the tops stay green, you'll see a little bit of expansion in the bulb yet, but that's just the nature of a transplant. Sets do exactly the same thing. So if you go buy little bulbs of onions at one of the nurseries or garden centers and plant those out, they tend to do the same kind of thing. They mature early. And under these types of long days and hot temperature conditions, they're going to mature a little bit earlier. And then the third thing is that you really need to know what type of onion it is. So we have short day onions, which really they're all long day types. So this verbiage is really confusing. So I'm going to try and simplify it. All onions are long days, but some have shorter long days, so they call them short. I tell my students, think of them as short long day, medium long day, and long long day. And so in our environment, we tend to grow more medium and long long day types for commercial purposes and also in our gardens. If you grow the short long day types, those are like the Vidalia onion, the sweet onions that you'd grow in Texas or in South Arizona or California. Mm-hmm. Those onions mature really, really early. So they have a short growing period. The mediums have a medium growing period. The longs have a long growing period. And so if he has a variety that's a little bit more toward the short long day types, that's another reason they can mature off. Yesterday we were out in some commercial onion fields. Most of those, the tops are standing up straight. They're filling out the bulbs. We have another 3 or 4 weeks before those will happen. And so people, you know, if you want to have early ones, grow seeds or sets. But if you want to have some that mature later, you know, plant some seeds out next year in early March or early April, excuse me, in our area, or late March in, you know, the Salt Lake Valley and some of the warmer areas of the state. And you'll have those grow through the whole summer, and they can then become good storage onions. And these ones you'll use a little quicker. So he's okay.
Okay, so we have Keith from St. George on the line. Hi, Keith. How can we help?
This year I planted potatoes.
Good.
And they grew, and the plants got really high.
Yep.
Now they've fallen over. The leaves look terrible. Some of them don't hardly have any leaves.
Yep.
What do I do?
Well, have you tried to dig any up to see what's underneath?
Oh, no. I'm still hoping that there's things down there.
Well, I would recommend that you go out and you start digging around and, you know, dig one up on the end of the row and see what your potatoes are like. Because usually when the vines start to die off and go a little bit, lose their leaves, and the vines start to collapse, that usually means that you have potatoes that are ready to be harvested underneath there. Now, your hot weather down in St. George also tends to accelerate the development of the plant a lot more, so they're going to mature a little quicker, and they just can't really make it through those 100 to 110 degree weather conditions that you guys experience all the time. So I would start digging potatoes and start using them.
Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Good luck with that. And I envy you that you have fresh dug potatoes, because they are so much better than anything else you eat.
Thanks.
Yep.
All right. Thanks, Keith.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Again, our toll-free number is 1-800-826-1495. Email zestygarden@gmail.com or post to our Facebook page at Utah Public Radio. I wanted to talk about garlic planting. And even though now's not necessarily the time to plant, you've got to order ahead. So why don't you address when to plant and the difference between long, or not long neck. See, you've got me going long neck. The hard necks
and the soft neck varieties. Well, really, if it comes down to hard necks and soft neck types, you know, it's going to be preferential for the consumer. Some people say that the one is a little stronger than the other. I mean, I don't know that I can tell the difference between them. Whatever your preference is, it really is just good to get some garlic into your garden. Now, should you start thinking about garlic now? Well, some people save garlic from year to year, and over time you'll find that clove size tends to decrease, and a lot of that has to do with the plant starts to acquire viruses, and the viruses, you know, restrict the ability of the plant to grow. You'll see it senesce off a little earlier. You'll start seeing some of the leaves yellow off a little quicker in the springtime. All of those are indicators that you probably have some virus. And so by ordering new seed periodically from a reputable garlic producer, you're going to get varieties, the same varieties that are virus-free. And so that's why you need to plan ahead for that. And you need to, it takes a little bit of time to find the variety that you want, order it, and get it shipped to you so that you can plant it out. So when's the appropriate time to plant? Generally up here in the Cache Valley region, we try to say get your garlic planted sometime in mid to late September. If you're in the Salt Lake Valley, you know, late September to early October. If you're down in warmer areas like Moab or into St. George, you'd probably want to be planting sometime in mid to late October. And what that will allow is the plant is quite hardy. It will grow for a little while in the fall. It'll produce a lot of roots. You may actually even see a few leaves come up. Those are all good things, because what the garlic needs is some cold weather to create divisions in the meristem. And the more divisions you have in the meristem, the more cloves that you're going to produce that are going to be garlic for you to eat.
So when I plant the day before the snow flies, they still come up, but I just don't get near the size.
You don't get very big ones, yeah. So yeah. You're just planting a little too late. Can you do that? Yes. Can you plant in the spring? Yes. Do you get good cloves from those? Generally, no.
Okay. So as far as the differences between the long... Here I go
long
again.
Neck.
Between the soft neck and the hard neck, if I remember correctly, the hard neck are more pungent and flavoring, but they don't store as well.
That's correct.
And the soft neck do store longer.
Do store longer, yes.
All right. So if you do soft neck, you just have to add more when you're cooking. I mean, I usually double the amount I see in the recipe
yeah,
anyway.
You know,
so.
I usually, Dawn tells me that I've added too much. So, you know, since I do a little bit of cooking in our house, I like garlic a lot, it's, you know, you just have to be careful.
And I suppose it also goes back again, how many taste buds per centimeter on your tongue. If you've got more, that's going
right.
to be a little more sensitive
that's
sort
exactly
of thing.
Right.
Okay. I wanted to also make sure we talked about fall planting.
Mm-hmm.
What can be put in the garden right now? What can you plant and still harvest?
Right now, probably not much. You know, it's early
Greens.
August. It's early August. You should have been planting, if you wanted, fall cabbage, fall broccoli, some of those kinds of things. It should have been done about the 1st of July or thereabouts, and they're going to struggle through the summer, but then they start to pick up speed once the temperatures start to cool off. Toward the end of August, you're going to start reseeding things like spinach, lettuce, maybe even some chards, your mustards, your arugulas, your radishes.
Could you do beets?
You may be able to get by with some beets, but it takes a little while. It just kind of depends.
You'll at least have greens.
You'll have greens. Know. That's exactly right. And they're sometimes as good as the bulb part of it. So you've got all of these cool season veggies that mature in a relatively short period of time that you can start harvesting shortly after they come up and start to utilize. But they just can't make it yet. The soil is too hot. We were doing some studies on planting, and what we found this summer is the soil temperature is so warm that things just have a hard time germinating. They just don't germinate under these conditions. So we need to wait a little bit of time for those. And so about the end of the month, you can start getting your lettuce and your radishes and any of those other leafy greens. Then you can put some row covers over top of them come the frost periods, and you'll have product all the way through October. And depending on how well you care for them, maybe all the way into November.
Can you ameliorate that by putting like a board down over the top so the soil doesn't get so warm?
You can do that, and it takes a little bit of extra work. We tried extra irrigations to keep the soil moist and cool, all of those things, and it's still so terribly hot in that surface layer of the soil that many of these small seeded crops like a spinach or like a lettuce that has to be seeded relatively shallow, the temperature just gets so warm there that they go dormant and they don't germinate at all. And as it cools off, if you did seed them, generally what you'll see is you'll start seeing them come up now toward the end of the month and into early September. So don't despair. Your work is not in vain, other than the weeds always seem to grow just fine at this time. They have no problem. That's right.
And then in the last minute and a half that we have, should there be any issues as far as adding any late season nutrients to our vegetables, any nitrogen, anything like that?
Well, in some of those cases where we're growing a little bit of leafy green and things like that, a lot of the crops that we've grown have used much of the nutrient that's in the soil. You may have to do a little bit of supplementation, particularly with some nitrogen, just to keep the plants vigorous and growing. You know, if you're into using organic fertilizer sources, you know, be careful with just adding more compost. And we all think that that's a good thing. It is, but, you know, we can overdo it too, particularly if it's manure-based compost that, you know, suddenly we get imbalances that occur in the soil. And, you know, we can talk more about those kinds of things maybe next month and as we get a little closer to that planting time, because, you know, the 1st of September when I'm back again, it'll be proper planting time for all of our fall greens.
I know at the last Thursday of this month, we'll be talking about doing some cover crops to help build the soil profile.
Excellent.
So, well, you've been listening to The Zesty Garden. My guest has been Dan Drost. He's USU's Extension Vegetable Specialist, is with us every second Thursday of the month. So plan on whatever the second Thursday is in September, and you'll be back then.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us on this edition of The Zesty Garden.
The Zesty Garden is a production of Utah Public Radio with producer Shalane Smith-Needham and Brian Earle. To listen to past programs or get additional information about the show, just go to upr.org. If you have an idea for an interview, including guests or topics, send your suggestions to zestygarden@gmail.com. You're listening to Utah Public Radio, KUSR HD1 Logan, KUSK HD1 Vernal, KUSL HD1 Richfield, KUST HD1 Moab, and KUSU FM HD1 91.5 Logan.
Stay with us for Performance Today, coming up next, followed by Exploring Music at 1 and BBC World News Hour at 3. It's 11 o'clock.